You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket Live with me, Simon Hughes, and you, Simon Mann. And if you're watching this, you can see us both. So hello, Simon. Everything all right there? You're not feeling too good today, are you?
No, not feeling great, but yeah, we soldier on. It's not COVID, by the way. It's just a wretched cold.
Well, it's that sort of weather, isn't it? Yeah. But I'm glad to say we've got lots of cricket to talk about here on this programme. And that's the idea of this show, is we're going to talk cricket and we want to talk with you, the viewers, and obviously the listeners. We're going to record this as a podcast as well. So if you are listening to it on the podcast, obviously the email address, actually, simonhughes@thecricketer.com is the best email for us. But obviously we want you to put some comments on the chat box as well, or ask us questions. We've got a question already, which we'll answer later. And we've got a packed show, actually, tonight, because we're talking about ball tampering. We're talking about the art of commentary, and we've got a couple of experts other than us. We're sort of, you know, apprentices in this world. We've got a couple of real experts to talk about it. And also, we're just going to discuss the IPL, the Vitality Blast, which is going on at the moment as well. They managed to get play underway on the reserve day at Edgbaston, and Surrey already through to the final. And now it's Lancashire against Notts. Lancashire going, well, quite well, actually, 89 for 4, and they're just about to finish their 11th over, which is at the end of the innings. So that match is interestingly poised. Notts will have to chase about 90-odd to win. Lots, as I say, happening in the cricket world. Please give us your comments on the chat box. Anything that you want to talk about, we'll try and pick up on. We're both in our homes, of course, here. Simon Mann is obviously got his library behind him. I've got my memorabilia, some pictures there of, actually, that's the World Cup final in one corner there, with Ben Stokes actually featured right around there. You can see that's Owen Morgan. And then there on that far left is Ben Stokes, the cover of the Cricketer magazine in that event when England won the World Cup. Ben Stokes, of course, is a talking point. I was with the owner of the Rajasthan Royals yesterday watching a rather dismal performance by the Rajasthan Royals. And as we were watching it, he said to me, Stokes is on the plane out to the UAE. He's finally decided to leave the family nest and his father. And interestingly, Simon, it was his father, Jed, who told him he should go, partly because he felt, you know, it was his duty, really. And he'd done his stint with the family. And also because Jed loves the IPL and he wants to watch it with his son playing in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been in New Zealand for a really long time now. He left the England team, towards the end of the summer. And the IPL without him it needs, I think Rajasthan Royals need him as well. They need him to play. And Jed, of course, is a huge backer of Ben's career. I think one of the interesting things is that people have just left him alone. There has been no news of Ben Stokes until he broke the news in his Mirror column with Dean Wilson over the weekend. And I know you'll be speaking to Manoj Badali. He's on his way and he's got to isolate for a week before he can play. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he's actually targeting the 14th of October as his first game against Delhi Daredevils. They're actually known as the Capitals now, Delhi Capitals. And so he'll have to sort of basically isolate for about a 6 days and then get into training. He's been training in New Zealand with, I think it's Sutherland or Sunderland Cricket Club. I think it's Sutherland in Christchurch, which is his old club. So he hopefully should have a reasonable degree of fitness, but he'll have to get up to speed quickly because the Royals, having won their first two games, lost the next two. So they'll need him really badly and they're really missing him. It's a great thing though. I think it must have been a hard decision actually for him to have to know when to leave, because he's gone there, you know, for very much to show support to his father and emotional support and all that. And it must be really hard to know when to leave again.
Yeah, really, really difficult situation. Really hard. What do you do in a situation like that? Without knowing more details about the illness, it's hard to say, isn't it, really? So it's not really worth speculating, but he has been over there for a long time now. He's been out of cricket for quite a long time since the test series back in the summer. I remember him leaving after the Manchester test match against Pakistan. Hello to Mick, who's joined us, and to Paul as well. We'll get on to your question, Mick, a little in a short while.
Yeah, and hello to Andrew Fothergill. Fothers, good to hear you and see you online, and have actually worked out the technology, and you can speak to each other. Of course, on the chat box. You don't have to just talk to us. So the whole point of this, in a way, is to try and create a bit of a community and get an exchange of information going. This is our new venture. We're thinking of doing it once a week, maybe on a Thursday night, especially during the winter when there's no cricket to enjoy, to get to, no club dinners or anything as well. Clubs are going to have to be sort of shut down pretty much for the winter. So we want to just try and keep the cricket conversation going with any sort of subjects that you want to talk about. One of the topics that has certainly come up, and you have brandished your ball there to illustrate that, is the ball tampering issue. Mitch Claydon of Sussex, who was banned for six games, sort of almost posthumously after his indiscretion in a championship game, a Bob Willis Trophy game. So what was he doing for a start? He was trying to rub hand sanitizer on the ball. What was the point of that? Well, I've actually got some hand sanitizer here. I thought what I'd actually do is try and rub some on the ball and see if it actually has any effect. So here I am with the ball. And actually, I mean, obviously, you're not going to be able to do this in a county game because it's totally kind of ostentatious. So you'd have to try and do it surreptitiously. But then if you then rub it on your jeans or your trousers, you should be able to get a reasonable shine on it. It's quite a dull shine, I have to say. It's not really kind of the shine I'd hope to get, and it leaves a pretty greasy mark. It makes the ball smell nice. I suppose that's one slight advantage. What's he trying to do? Well, obviously he's trying to get a polish. What is any bowler trying to do? He's trying to get a polish on one side and keep the other side rougher. And I can share my screen here actually, because somebody very much cleverer than me, a guy down at Bath University in the mechanical engineering department, the aerodynamics department, in fact, drew a very complicated graphic trying to illustrate swing. And I'm going to try and share my screen and show you this graphic. So here, hopefully it is. I don't know if you can see that. I share my screen now. Can you see that, Simon?
Yep, the
two types of swing. So on the left, we've got conventional swing with the shiny side at the bottom and the rough side at the top. And obviously, the conventional swing, what happens is if you look at the left-hand side of that graphic, the air travels quicker across the shiny side and there's more turbulence across the rougher side. So the ball is dragged towards the turbulent side. That's kind of the very rough, fairly non-scientific explanation, but it's all about boundary layers. The air passing across the ball slightly quicker on the bottom side there, and it says laminar flow streamlined. So the air passing quicker along the bottom and slightly kind of turbulent air along the top of the ball, dragging the ball with the rough side. It also helps that the seam is tilted because that acts as a rudder for the swing. So that's the kind of swing that Mitch Claydon was trying to get by applying the sanitizer on the bottom of the ball, which obviously is illegal. You're not supposed to apply anything that is not a natural substance. You're not supposed to apply sun cream, although I must admit I did once or twice in my career, not that it helped particularly. Now, on the right-hand side, we've got that art of reverse swing, which is a science which really nobody understands. It's very difficult to explain. But this scientist at Bath University did his best with this drawing. And basically, over time, on a very dry pitch, a very rough pitch, abrasive pitch, the ball gets pitted and really scratched up on both sides. It's very important to try and keep the rough but shiny side, the bottom of that diagram, as dry as possible. And then the other side, the top side there, has become rougher and rougher over time. They've just allowed it to really deteriorate. And what you actually get in the end is because of there is super turbulence on that very rough side. And the super turbulence actually creates a sort of bouncing effect and bounces the ball in the other direction, makes it curve in the other direction. So if we go back to the left-hand diagram again, the turbulence causes the swing to one way, but the super turbulence bounces it to swing the other way. And that is a very layman's explanation, but hopefully that kind of makes it tiny bit clearer for one or two people who hadn't got a clue about it. Or maybe it's just totally confused everybody. What do you think, Simon?
Well, okay. So which side were the Australians applying their sandpaper then?
Well, they were trying to apply it to the rougher side. I mean, I've got a really rough, pretty rough ball here. So, you know, they were trying to really scratch up this very rough side to make it super rough and then cause it to bounce against the rough side or swing against the rough side to create reverse swing. And obviously it happens more with the sort of white, actually it happens more with the white ball. So this white ball here, you can see is quite badly scratched. And often you find white balls and the kookaburra balls, and which are pink ones and white ones, tend to scuff up much more than the Duke's balls, which are handmade and tend not to scuff nearly as much. Well, I mean, of course, now we'd have to decide, was it a fair penalty? Because the penalties for ball tampering, which is effectively what rubbing sanitizer on the ball is, are quite random in a way. You know, the sandpaper gate ban was for quite a significant amount of time, but this one was 9 games.
Yeah, and he'd already served, by the time it's come out, he's already served 6 matches of that ban. And then I think he's only got to serve 2 games at the start of next season. But I mean, it is the biggest ban that a player has been given it for ball
Freudian slip.
Well, yeah, for ball tampering in this country. The question from Mick is, you know, why ball tampering isn't considered a more serious breach of the laws? Surely cheating of any sort should be severely punished. I'm interested to see actually what Mick thinks Mitchell Claydon's punishment should be. The Australians, they were banned for a year. I mean, I actually thought that was too long. I thought that was really, really harsh. Of course, it was transgressing the laws, but a year ban for doing something that actually all bowlers try to do. I know, a lot of bowlers try to do it. I mean, you said it yourself. You know, you applied sun cream. Mm. I mean, there's talk of
the seam. I mean, we tried to pick the seam. You know, obviously, you're not allowed to do that either. But the seam is actually almost more important, funnily enough, than the shine, because the more you can pick the seam, the more that rudder can really act in a very bold way to actually help the ball to swing.
Picking
the seam is sort of by, well, I shouldn't be telling you this. This is like burglar's tricks, isn't it? But, you know, basically by running your fingernail underneath the seam here to lift it up so that the seam is prouder. And actually, there was a chap I played with at Ealing Cricket Club. I won't name him, but he played in the Middlesex League quite often. And his job, he was a rubbish cricketer. He batted and bowled very poorly. His main job was fielding at gully with a very strong thumbnail to pick the seam. So, you know, it has happened forever in the game. And I don't know, I sort of think I don't mind a bit of sun cream rubbed on the ball personally. I think, you know, you shouldn't be. The difference with that sort of Australian scenario and the sandpaper gate was it was so blatant. Yeah. You know, bringing something on an external device or implement or a piece of sandpaper in this case, you know, to bring that out and to deliberately have this intent to scratch the ball with something like that. I mean, if you're just using your fingernails or a bit of sun cream on your from your forehead, or I mean, I don't. I think that's hard to police, really. Well, if you're actually bringing things on extra implements to do it with, then that's blatant cheating.
It's a grey area, isn't it? The sun cream, because you've got sun cream on your, you know, on your forehead, on your cheeks, on your nose, and you're going to sweat, and you're allowed to put sweat on the ball. So it's you know, it's a really great. It's the same with the sweets, isn't it? You know, you're allowed to put saliva on the ball. Players, you know, we know for a fact that in 2005 Ashes, the England players sucked sweets, and the ball did swing. Now, what are we to say about that? Is that, you know?
Yeah, and the 12th man who brought out sugar-free Murray Mints by mistake was promptly sacked because there's no point having, you know, non-sugary sweets to try and polish the ball with. Anyway, I mean, it's an interesting issue. It's going to one that's going to run and run because bowlers will always try their best to bend the rules and try and find ways to make the ball move. I've got not much sympathy with Mitch Clayton because he was doing something obviously that wasn't allowed, and everybody knows that you're not supposed to rub any cream into the ball, whether it's sanitizer or sun cream or Vaseline or anything.
Well, what he did was they had these sanitizer breaks where you bring out the sanitizer, you rub. What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to rub it into your hands like that. What I understand he did was he put it on his hands and sort of held one hand there, and then, you know, when he next in possession of the ball, got the ball to did that to the ball. So he's actually rubbing the sanitizer into the ball. And he was given a 9-match ban for that. So how much had he been given? Back to Mick's question. I mean, you could argue that a 9-match ban is a severe punishment. And it's true. It's also extremely embarrassing, isn't it, as well? Because you've been, you know, you're sort of banged to rights. Everybody knows that you tried to cheat, basically.
I should answer Sean Fisher. Fisher's asked a question here, actually. Thanks for that, Sean. And he says, great explanation. That's the first comment I've ever had for that explanation. Did you ever achieve reverse swing, Simon? I did, actually. And funnily enough, we never called it reverse swing in those days. You know, we're talking black and white era pretty much. And I had a game, particularly when I played against Pakistan for Middlesex at Lords, and it was a very dry, abrasive pitch in sort of mid-August, I think, and the ball was getting scratched up quite badly. And I was one of those bowlers who did play around with the grip and the seam position and swing and shiny side and all that to see what would happen, normally because it was flying plumb line straight. So I'd try anything I could to get the ball to move around. And this particular day, I was holding it for an outswinger. So I was holding it with the shiny side on this side here to swing it away, the right-hand side to swing it away. And it was swinging the other way, a much older ball than this. It was swinging in the opposite direction. So then I flicked it over. So the shiny side was now in a position on the left to swing in, and it swung away. And so I thought, well, fine, great. It's going well. I made the ball move around quite a lot, got about 3 wickets, and I didn't know what to call it. So I just told the other bowlers, and one or two of them found it worked as well. So we just said, well, today it's the ball's behaving a bit mysteriously, but go with it. And reverse swing really only got christened probably about 5-6 years after that, in the 90s, especially when Wasim Akram and Waka Yunis were the masters of it.
Yeah, Mick's come back to us. You know, I suppose I didn't consider the fact that guilty player would also have to face other players and crowds, knowing that he's been caught cheating. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is quite embarrassing, but it is very embarrassing for Mitch Clayton, as much as anything, isn't it? The fact that he has been highlighted, that, you know, his crime or whatever, if inverted commas, has been highlighted. We should just talk about the cricket that's going on at the moment. The Chennai Super Kings going really well in their match against Kings 11 Punjab. They haven't had a great time of it so far, the Chennai Super Kings, but they look as if they're on course for victory in that game. And the blast is going on at the moment. I mean, it was so wet earlier, that Surrey-Gloucestershire match, players slipping on the outfield. I mean, it's amazing that they're even playing at all. And I see Notts are just beginning their reply to Lancashire's score of 94 for four from their 11 overs and knots are underway. And just talking about knots, there's a question from Chris, who says, watching the Blast semi-final, how well does Alex Hales need to do over the next year or so to force his way back into the England team? Well, I mean, that is an interesting question. It opens up quite a lot, actually, because I have the sense that as long as Owen Morgan is England's T20 captain, Alex Hales will not play. I think they feel that he let them down badly before the World Cup. This trust issue. I mean, I don't think the story's been fully told, but I think it will be one day, or perhaps it never will. But I think they felt they let them down so badly that it will not happen, which is, it is a huge shame because Alex Hales is, tremendously talented player. And I think he does get into England's best T20 side.
Well, he might do, but I mean, there's a lot of people now queuing up for that sort of opening number three, number four area. I mean, Joe Root can't even get into that T20 side. And you've got Butler. They want to open the batting with Butler, but you've also got Roy, you've got Bairstow, you've got Sam Billings, you've got Tom Banton. So it's going to be tough for him. And I think he's kissed it goodbye. Unless he hits incredible amounts of runs, I agree with you. I think certainly while Morgan's captain, but also, these young guys like Tom Banton are coming up behind as well and showing tremendous range of skill and power and confidence. So it's going to be really tough for Alex Hales. He might just have to, satisfy himself with playing franchise cricket, and I'm sure he'll do very well. I mean, he's hitting the ball quite well so far today. I mean, it's a shame, isn't it, really? Because, two, 3 years ago, he's playing test cricket and four-day cricket, and he's rather kind of forced himself into a corner, which is it's a shame for him, and it's a shame for the game because he's talented and he's great to watch.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you on that. I mean, I think he does get in England's best T20 11. I think he's talented enough. I accept that Tom Banton's coming through. There's David Milan as well, who's been part of England's top order of late. But I think if Hales, if all things being equal, of course they're not, all things being equal for me, Hales gets in England's best 11.
Okay. Right, let's answer that question that we had. We've got a couple of questions here. What advice do you have? It doesn't say who asked this question. But
Jai's asked it.
Jai, is it? Oh, yeah, Jai, you're right. Yeah, sorry. What advice do you give for a teenager who's played in county age group cricket since 9 years old? I think, obviously, that shows you're talented and that you've been recognised by the county coaches. I think stick at it. I mean, they're going to probably go for some winter training to encourage you to take part in that. I think I would say, actually, if you're a teenager, particularly, I think watch as much cricket as you can. You learn so much from watching the game. I just spend all my life as a teenager watching cricket, watching tests, and not much one-day cricket was on. I mean, a bit of sort of Benson and Hedges Cup or something when I was a kid, but mostly it was the test matches that I watched, and I just learned so much and copied bowlers. And I think copy the best players and try out the stuff. And Steve Smith's got a nice little drill, which, works in lockdown, which is something he liked to sort of encourage people to do. And that's just if you can find a wall anywhere, even indoors or outdoors, and just throw a tennis ball against the wall and just practice hitting it back again. And as the ball rebounds, you time it, then it rebounds again, and just hit it lots of times, a bit like tennis, sort of solo tennis practice, but using a cricket bat instead and a tennis ball. Obviously, you have to watch out for China and, other breakable implements. But if you can find a space to do that, and just watch loads of cricket and try copying the best players, whoever they may be. What do you think, Simon?
Yeah, well, practice as much as you possibly can. I mean, when I think back to when I was 12, 13, 14, if I could have played, if I could, say, gone in the nets and batted every day during the winter in indoor nets, I would love that opportunity. So if you get that opportunity to practice as much and develop your skills as much as possible, take it. I mean, one of the problems we have in this country is the weather outdoors. You find a Saturday it's raining, you can't play. Just take every opportunity you possibly can. Find someone to bowl at you and practice those strokes.
Now let's move on to our other topic here with Hales and Duckett going quite well for Notts, 23 for none after the best part of two overs. So that's a racing start for Notts against Lancashire, chasing 94 to win, 95 to win. How do you become a commentator? Or, you know, what is the best way of being a commentator? And what are the, you know, the skills of a commentator that are most valuable in a way? Commentary has changed, hasn't it, a bit? I mean, you watch the IPL and you sometimes cringe, really, to be honest, don't you? There's just too much shouting. And I really feel that commentary, especially TV commentary, should be trying to add to the pictures. The viewers can see what's happened. So to be able to say, oh, it's, there it is, gone over the rope before, is just so boring. You've got to try and add something by saying why something happened or how it happened, not what it happened. What's your take on it, Simon?
Well, I think one of the things I would say about IPL commentary is that that's how I think there's a sort of Faustian pact with being an IPL commentator, is that you're expected to deliver it in a certain way. And you know, you have to do all the adverts as well, don't you? You know, it's a Seat tyres timeout, it's an XYZ six, or you know, it's an XYZ moment of the match. So if you're going to work for the IPL, you have to
Yes Bank maximum.
Is it? You have to buy into that. So in a way, I it's easy to be critical of sometimes of commentators do the IPL. There are lots of them because there are lots of matches. But I think just remember that you know, because you want to work in the biggest tournament in world cricket, certainly the biggest domestic tournament in world cricket. You know, it's tremendous, the amount of people watching it, and the money involved is vast, and you know, the sponsorship deals, all that sort of thing. So you want to be part of it. So you sort of have to toe the line a bit. You know, you have to give it that extra amount. I mean, I suppose, you know, from an audience point of view, you could watch it with the sound down, but then that rather, you know, that lessens the experience. So don't be so critical of the IPL commentators. I agree. I think there's definitely been a move in recent years to talk more on television than there was in the past. I mean, there was, you know, Richie Beno's old maxim about only
saying too much
if you can add to the pictures. I think sometimes there is, you say, you know, don't say, oh, that's, you know, that's gone for four. I think sometimes there is, in a commentary, you sometimes have to sort of confirm what the viewer is seeing a little bit sometimes. If you didn't say anything, if the ball ran into the rope and you didn't say anything, people say, well, hold on, I know it's a four, but you sort of have to give some idea of the impact of that boundary to the, match or the over or whatever. I think you have to, you do have to sort of go with that confirmation, but yeah, as much as possible, try to add to the pictures rather than say the obvious.
Right. So I'm now going to give you some examples of commentary, sports commentary. The first one is perhaps a little bit extreme, and then after that, we'll hear some slightly more masterly ones. Okay. So this one, I mean, brace yourself for this, because this is the sort of extreme version of sports commentary.
Aí aparece o Cleberson de novo, já parte pela direita. Cafu já partiu na velocidade. Ele cortou para o meio, lá vem o Cleberson. Rivaldo saiu para o Ronaldinho, pé direito, bateu. Gol!
Brasil!
What would happen to you if you were commentating on a test match and, you know, Owen Morgan, a one-day match, and Owen Morgan hit a massive six and you shouted like that? Would you get sacked?
I don't know, actually. I think everyone's allowed to develop their own individual style. My theory about the commentators shout goal is they're actually buying themselves some time so they can work out who's actually scored that goal. That was one of my theories. But it becomes vogue, doesn't it? That sort of commentary, you're expected to deliver that sort of commentary if a goal goes in.
Yeah, actually, I think it's good breath control there as well. I thought it's like that. Whenever I hear a bit of commentary like that, it reminds me of that singer Bill Withers and the "Lovely Day" song, where he just goes "Lovely Day" and he keeps going. I've often counted how long that hole lasts, and it's about 24 seconds. So, you know, maybe you need to be a Brazilian football commentator, you need good breath control. Now, let's hear some slightly more cerebral commentary. These are two favourite clips of mine by two outstanding commentators. The first one you'll recall from the 2005 Ashes, the conclusion of that game. And then the second one, I don't think it needs any introduction. So have a listen to these two.
Jones! Bowden! Kasprovic, the man to go, and Harmison has done it. Despair on the faces of the batsmen and joy for every England player on the field.
And here it is, folks. This is the moment. It's Archer to Guptill. Two to win. Guptill's going to push for two. They've got to go. It's got three. It's got to go to the keeper's end.
Go on, go on.
Yeah!
Go on!
Well, that was actually recorded in the VT truck. Yeah, it was in the truck at the World Cup final where we were producing the analysis, and so all that cheering was all the VT operators, the videotape operators. But for me, the two people that I've worked with who are the best, and I'm sorry not to have you, Simon, in this group of two, is Ian Smith and Richie Benno, because they are so pared down with their words. And they're actually the great thing about Smith, I think, in particular, is he always tried to find a new way of saying things. You know, he's got the lovely turns of phrase, but he says he goes to the game every day sort of trying to think, okay, there's going to be lots of boundaries and lots of wickets and lots of twos and ones and different incidents. I'm going to try and think of new ways to describe those rather than the old cliches. I mean, what do you think of that, and do you do that?
I think that's really good advice, actually. One of the things I try to do is I try to, you know, there's so many cliches in sport. You know, people talk about maximum. That's a cliche for me. Those little phrases, words, whatever that people use in commentary, to try to get rid of all of those. So I get actually really annoyed with myself if I find myself reaching for a cliche. And I totally agree with you. Try to find a different way of saying something. It's not easy because, you know, you're sort of seeing the same thing over and over again in a way, just in a different order. So that, I think that's brilliant advice. In terms, you know, lots of people do preparation for their commentary, but actually thinking about trying to explain the game or talk about the game in a different way, a way you haven't heard before, is a fantastic piece of advice.
I mean, Benno was always fascinating to watch at work because he did a lot of preparation, but he didn't prepare phrases. He just prepared his knowledge. And he used to sort of set himself up in the corner of the commentary box with his little, what I called his nest. It was his nest. It was his little Tupperware box of sandwiches. He loved banana sandwiches for some reason. And then he had this laptop with this a screensaver of a train chugging across it, and his copy of the Racing Post and his copy of Tom Smith's scoring and umpiring the laws of the game, the sort of Bible about the laws of the game, really. And he always had that close to hand as well. And, you know, he would often be sort of typing when he wasn't actually commentating. He'd often be typing away, but he noted everything. He never missed a thing. He seemed to have this ability to, his eyes seemed to sort of roll round the side of his head and always pick out something sort of that seemed to be happening in a corner of the ground he didn't seem to appear to be looking at. You know, so his attention to detail was immense. And Smith the same. I mean, in the end, you need that passion, don't you, to want to watch the game. So some of the kind of less good commentators are people who are famous, but they actually don't like watching cricket very much. So they miss a lot. So therefore, they probably come out with a lot of cliches.
Here's a question from Jim. He says, hi, both. Simon Mann, you are expected to deliver to a commentary brief. Or if you're expected to deliver to a commentary brief, what's the brief from BBC Radio? Well, I don't think there is. I mean, I don't think I am expected to deliver to a commentary brief. I think you have your own ideas about how your commentary should sound. And you work to that brief, really, Jim. And my sort of template is that I want to, every ball, I want to give as full a description as possible from the moment the bowler runs into ball and deliver the ball to the moment the ball is dead. So I see it as a sort of, I've often explained this as a sort of piece of elastic. So I want to get from one end of the elastic to the other. And sometimes that elastic is smaller. So, for example, if a spinner's on and you're involved in a good story, and your summarizer is telling a good story, you might say X bowls and B blocks it back down the pitch, no run. So that's a really short piece of description. But you might find, X runs into bowl, that's clipped away to deep back with square leg. So you've got a very clear description of where the ball has gone. It's picked up by Y, who throws it on the bounce to the wicketkeeper. One run to the total, 116 for two. So there's your sort of piece of elastic, if you want. And within that is the basic, that's the blocks of your commentary. And that is the sort of the foundation stone of everything, really. And once you've done that, and everything else you can build on top of it, the stories, the color, the recap, the conversation that goes around a cricket commentary. That's how I try to approach it.
Yeah, good. Knots 50 for one, 45 to win from 41 balls, coasting along here, looking like they're going to eliminate Lancashire from it. Let's just listen to a slightly alternative view about, you know, the art of commentary from, as I told you before, one of the most recognisable voices and faces of the game. I went up to visit him actually last week in North Yorkshire in a place called Boston Spa. Some of you might know it. It is, of course, Geoffrey Boycott. And one of the little questions I asked him, and I've just seen there, Alex Hale, beautifully bowled by a really good leg break that spun past his little propped forward defence and knocked his off stump over. So he's gone for 29. Here's Geoff Boycott. And I talked to him about his commentary and when he first started commentating and what he learned from it. In fact, he said that he first commentated in about the 1970s and was then given little bits of advice and really got in. He really enjoyed his first few stints at it and then obviously got into it properly when he retired. So this is explaining, firstly, what he got from his first few goes and then what he learned as a result.
And that was the first bit. I liked it. And from then on, I always thought, yeah, I wanted to do that. I mean, there's many people want to do it. Better than my dad working down a coal mine, isn't it? But it's, are you any good at it? That you never know. So I asked advice to Richie Benno and Jim Laker. Jim Laker was a good man, top man. Richie's good. If you ask Richie, always helpful. And I always remember what he said to me then. He said, people can see while watching television what's happening. Just saying it's a good shot. Well, they can see whether it's a good shot or a bad shot. And you get out. Don't state the obvious. Try and give them something that adds to their enjoyment. I mean, today a lot have got in the habit of talking as if they're doing radio commentary, don't they?
Partly because they are at the same time.
Yes, and they forget that there are two different mediums. And television, nearly everybody that watches television has some idea about the game, some have a very good idea. They've all played at school or club cricket or maybe are still playing. So they're not dumplings, they all know. I always try to talk to them as if it's my brother or my uncle or and try and keep quiet a bit. Let them watch. Try and say something that enhances their watching.
And you became, well known for your obviously sort of straightforward analysis and blunt kind of appreciation of the game, but also for sort of some regular words and phrases. I could have caught that in the mother's pinny, stick a rhubarb, corridor of uncertainty. Where did those all come from?
Just instinct. I didn't work at them. I've never worked at anything. I haven't sat down and with a paper and pen and writing phrases down that I'll use tomorrow or next day. I study the game, always have. I've been in love with the game all my life, still are. I love it. I can watch cricket. Even though I've played 25 years, commentated 30, I love it. So it's not a hardship for me to watch cricket. It really isn't. I really enjoy it. And I actually like reading about the history, the great players of the past and things they're doing and get a feel for what they were like. And I think if I had to say something about the modern day player, he doesn't read enough about the past. Which is a shame, really. It doesn't put them in the shadow. but it's nice to know about what other people did.
Because there's such a rich history, isn't there?
Yeah, you say to people about, you heard of Sidney Francis Barnes? Who's he? You know, he might be the road sweeper. They've no idea who he is. He's probably the greatest bowler that's ever bowled for England. They haven't a clue. And I think that's sad, isn't it?
Well, there you are. There's Geoffrey's view about it. I like the way he says sometimes he keeps quiet. Can't shut him up in the commentary box normally. But, there are some sage words there. And actually, I like his point about history. I do think that the young players, the modern player, doesn't really know much about the history of the game. Do you agree with that?
Mm. Well, difficult to know, actually. I mean, I think there are some what they call cricket badgers out there who do know a lot about the game. And others, they think that the game was invented about 5 years ago. Well, I suppose in a way, it sort of was, wasn't it, with T20, well, I say 5 years ago. I mean, in a strange way, we have a completely different game now. We've been watching the IPL, watching the Blast today. Chennai Super Kings have won by 10 wickets, beating the
Kings. Really?
Yeah, wow. 10 wickets with 2.2 overs to spare. 181 for no wicket. Watson and Duplessis with that stand of 181. So, in a sense, the game has... it was invented, 2003, was it, 2004?
2003, yeah, 2020,
2020 wasn't invented then, because we all played it growing up as kids. Yeah. But what we know as...
Professional get T20 was invented in 2003,
So in a sense... But, I mean, there is such a rich history. And I know Geoffrey's, he's in love with SF Barnes, because he was a wonderful bowler at sort of start of the 20th century. And I think one of the great things for people watching the game now is when we talk about, Michael Holding or Malcolm Marshall, it's all there, isn't it? But I would love to be able to go back and watch the Bodyline series, in the way we go back and watch the 2005 Ashes or the 1981 Ashes. You'd love to be able to go back and watch the whole series or highlights of the whole series. All that stuff in the past does seem a bit dim and distant, I think, to us, because we probably, we can't see it.
Well, that's one of our ideas, isn't it? Is that we're going to actually, in this new venture, we're going to, at some point during the winter, we're going to start maybe watching some old replays of games which we can all access. So perhaps actually watching some highlight reels of the 2005 Ashes together would be quite fun. Brilliant catch there on the boundary. Has got rid of another Nottinghamshire wicket, Skyer, to long off. So Nottinghamshire just faltering here at 39-3 now. And 59-3 rather. So they still need another 36 to win. The batsman there completely lost his grip on the bat, skied it to long off. I went to visit Geoffrey, actually, and I'll just show you. This is the picture. I'm talking of sort of history and being aware of history. He's very aware of his own history. If we have a look at this picture here, I'll just show you. This was taken in his sitting room. Hopefully you can see that, everybody. We were nicely masked up and, of course, socially distanced. Well, not really, I suppose. But notice the lovely portrait behind him in his main kitchen, admiring his on drive. Every day when he gets up, he was in good shape, actually. Generally, he seemed, generally in good health. He was being quite careful, but sensibly so. And we're going to run some more of his interview in the next week or so on the podcast to keep the build up to his 80th birthday, which is the 21st of October.
Mm. Yeah, well, he's. He's had a massive impact on the game, hasn't he? Both as a player and a commentator over the years. We used to play a little game which is called Boycott Bingo on Test Match Special, which is whenever those phrases come up, you mark your bingo card, and someone actually sent in a Boycott Bingo cake once with all the little phrases on it. It was an incredible thing, like catch it in your mother's pity or coronal certainty and all those sorts of things.
I love that story, actually. He said once that two young Yorkshire players came to pick him up because he used to live with his mum till his mother died, sadly, in 1978. So when he was sort of in his mid-20s, early 30s, he still lived with his mum. And Neil Hartley and Kevin Sharp, I think, two young Yorkshire players, went to pick him up from home one day to take him to the game. And they knocked at the door, and Mrs. Boycott, the mum, answered. And she's only about 5'1" or something. And so one of them said, "Blimey, Mrs. Boycott, you're not very big for all those runs and wickets you score," which she didn't quite understand. But I think we all know exactly what they meant by the number of times he used to say, "Well, you know, my mum could have hit that with her clothes prop." We've got a question here, actually, as it looks like Nottinghamshire lost another wicket, 61 for 4, Joe Clark gone for 17. So they need 34 from 30 balls now. Just a little bit of a wobble. They should get it, but they've lost 4 wickets. A question here, changing subject slightly. Do you both agree with Chris Wokes being voted the NatWest PCA Men's Player of the Year? And I think, well, I certainly do. I think he's been so consistent. He's Mr. Reliable for England, isn't he? And if you look at the performances in the Test matches, not only does he average better than both Anderson and Broad at home, his wickets taken at 22, but also, of course, he made that match-winning 84 not out against Pakistan to bail England out and seal that series. So, and actually, you know, his fielding is so safe. His bowling is always incredibly reliable. He plays second fiddle to the Broads and the Andersons, but he never complains. He's just one of cricket's great guys that deserves all the awards he gets. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A really decent man and a very good cricketer. You're right. He's one of those cricketers who he's sort of always a bit under the radar. He's sort of overshadowed, I suppose, by Anderson Broadbent. Had a great summer with the ball, and he helped win England a Test match, well, a Test series really, because that series against Pakistan finished 1-0. There was lots of rain in the last two games, and you know Pakistan could easily have won the series because that was basically the decider that first Test match.
Mm. And actually, you know, all round stats pretty good. 10 county hundreds and 1 Test hundred, but it's his sort of evergreenness, isn't it? He's just a perennial fixture in the team, gets on with his job, never kind of makes a song and dance or any histrionics about bowling from into the wind or the end it's not very favourable with a slightly older ball or whatever. And I suppose, you know, in an era when if there wasn't a Ben Stokes, he would be England's best all-rounder. He would have been one of England's best all-rounders that ever lived, probably, because... But he's overshadowed because of the presence of Stokes.
Yeah, he's a fine cricketer. And I suppose the challenge for him now is, you know, can he turn some of the good stats in England into good stats abroad? You know, you think of the Ashes series coming up, and winter after this one. You know, he was there last time, and Broad and Anderson were there last time, and England did not, you know, they couldn't make any inroads into the Australian batting lineup with the presence of Archer. Can they actually put some pressure on Australia this time? That's going to be the next challenge. It's interesting actually listening to Jimmy Anderson talking about, and Stuart Broad actually, he was saying that about bowling in Australia, the key to doing well as a bowling side in Australia is having runs on the board. He's almost like saying it's over to the batsmen. They've really got to make the massive scores, the 500s, the 600s, which is of course what Australia did against England last time in the Ashes in Australia, Steve Smith rattling out all those runs. So it's almost like saying, you know, it is hard to bowl in Australia. It is sort of a batsman's game. So our batsmen need to make the most of it. They need to go big. And I think that's part of England's template for trying to do well in the Ashes. But I mean, hopefully lots more cricket before then. And the big challenge of India and a challenge from Sri Lanka. But we don't quite know when the international cricket is going to be played. We hope there's international cricket, but we don't quite know. It hasn't been finalised yet.
No, it hasn't. And we had Ashley Giles on this show the other day just talking about the winter and, you know, winter plans and really, you know, being very much not sure, hoping to go to South Africa in possibly November. I mean, this IPL is going to take out some of the players. Stokes has just arrived. He's going to get 7 games in, but the IPL doesn't finish till the 10th of November. And they're not going to really want to schedule anything before that. And then Christmas comes fairly quickly after that. And then they're planning to go to Sri Lanka and India in the new year. So it's a busy potential, but who knows with the pandemic, you know, coming and going and fluctuating. my daughter's house in Durham have all got it now. So we're next, I guess. You don't sound great today, but you said you're not COVID. Now, one guy that we've been trying to protect very recently, particularly from COVID, is someone that I'm just going to take the story briefly away from cricket, actually, and make it very topical, because the guy that that my partner and I have been sharing a house with for the last sort of couple of months is a man called Stephen Scullion, who is Ireland's best marathon runner. And today, in the London Marathon, he broke the Irish record. He came 11th in the elite men's race, so just behind all the Kenyans, who were the stars of the show, but only about 3 minutes behind. He finished with a time of just under 2 hours, 10 minutes, which is astonishingly 19.6 kilometres an hour speed for the whole race.
Incredible, isn't it?
Amazing. I mean, amazing. And he's very dedicated. He quite often he goes up to bed, you know, at sort of 10 o'clock at night, and he says, oh, no, in the afternoon, actually. You'll go and do a training run, and then he'll go to bed at sort of 4. And he says, I'm off to bed. It's work, you know, he says, because it, you know, sleep is a very important part of his preparation. Anyway, today, not only did he, as I say, break the Irish record with his run, but also he became second fastest man marathon level in Europe, because only one person, non-Kenyan or Ethiopian, got into the top 15, and he came 11th. So anyway, I thought, just out of interest, I saw him after the race. He came home briefly to collect his things before, I think, going out on a big bit of a razzmatazz celebration. So I just thought I'd ask him a couple of questions about the whole experience. And this is what he said. You've broken the Irish record in the London Marathon.
Yeah.
Do you realise you're now the second fastest marathon runner in Europe? How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I feel pretty good. You know, it's been a lot of hard work, but it's really nice when days like today come off. And I guess we all have ideas about how good we can think, or how good we think we can be. But to be able to go out there and actually show it on a stage like London, it's super, super impressive. Really happy.
And what about the weather? How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I think it made it more of a mental battle. And, you know, at some parts of the race, I really didn't deal with it that well. I was pretty negative mentally. But, yeah, I guess you just have to deal with whatever you're given. And you could be negative about it, or you could be really positive that given the current COVID situation, we're out there racing, and that's really good.
What was the hardest part? What's the hardest stage?
I would probably say from like mile 14 to mile 18 or 19, when you're still a little bit away from sniffing the finish line, you could say. But, you know, the race is really starting to get a bit tough. Legs are starting to get tough. Today, the legs were getting cold. The arms were getting cold. Yeah, probably mile 14 to 19.
And how did you get through it then?
Because you're on your own, weren't you? Yeah, I was on my own. Yeah, no, I do my best to just talk my psychology around, and 1 mile at a time, get through 1 mile. And I actually told one of the boys today that you have to kind of ignore what's going on physically. And if you get through the next mile and it looks pretty good, you say, oh, nice, I'm still going okay. And that's kind of quite reassuring.
Can you get quicker?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll get quicker in my next one. Maybe if I get some nice weather. I never get bloody nice weather, but yeah, I'll go faster.
Because I've realised that you run 19 kilometres an hour rate for 26 miles. I can't even keep up with that on the bike.
I think it's 19.7 now.
Oh, sorry. So nearly 20. Yeah, nearly 20 kilometres. But I can't even do that on a bike for 15 minutes. So what advice have you got for me then?
Look, it's all about consistency, you know. Like, you're training once or twice a day, you're going the altitude, but not everybody has to do that. Like,
there's not much altitude in Bushy Park.
No, just consistency. Just keep putting it in and learn things, research, Google, figure it out. You could probably change your seat height and change the pedals, and you'd be faster.
Change the bike, maybe.
Yeah, maybe change the bike. Yeah.
What are you going to do now?
Take a bit of recovery.
No, I mean, actually, right.
Now. Oh, I'm going into hit pints in London. I'll put like a 8 pint limit, maybe.
And it's going to be Guinness, presumably.
If they have it, yeah. I hope so. But I'll have one Guinness, and if it's not up to scratch, then I'll just have to have beer.
Well done. We're very proud
of you. Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much.
Have a good night.
Yeah.
You deserve it.
Right, Simon, buddy.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Oh God, what an feat. What an amazing event. And now he's going to paint the town red.
8 pints after running the marathon.
Well, you've got to put the fluid back somehow, haven't you? I mean, don't blame him. And I'll tell you what, he says maybe change the bike to make me go faster. I think just change the person, actually, is maybe more sensible. Amazing athlete, though. And sleep is very much one of the things he does. And sleep, massage, obviously training runs and things. But that's a fantastic feat. That's Stephen Scullion, who now holds the new Irish record for the London Marathon. And, yeah, impressive. Watch out for him. He's going to be in the Olympics. He's not in the GB Olympic team because he runs for Ireland, which is a sort of weird anomaly, even though it's Northern Ireland. So, anyway, he's a very talented athlete and a lovely guy, and I'm sure he'll be quite drunk in the next few hours. So I think that we're just watching the conclusion of this Nottinghamshire Lancashire game, which was very interesting, actually. But Dan Christian hit 4 sixes off Liam Livingston and put the game pretty much out of reach of Lancashire. And then he got out. But they've just won now. Notts Outlaws have won by 5 wickets. Matt Parkinson has been hit back over his head for 4 to conclude that match. So the Notts Outlaws win. It's been quite an entertaining little 11-over spell, that, actually, with lots of sixes and quite a few wickets as well. It was full-on action, but Lancashire eliminated and Notts are through to the final to play Surrey, which will take place, I guess, you know, in about half an hour's time. So it's full-on at Edgbaston. We'll leave them to it. Just one little sort of note for your diary, really, is I mentioned boycott and I mentioned interviews. So we've actually put him on the cover of the magazine anyway, which I'll just show you. There it is. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Nice cover, boycott at 80. We also focus actually on Somerset and Essex, who are the two, we've named them the sort of two cricket superpowers, really, in county cricket, because they sort of keep performing so well in the county championship, and there were the two finalists, of course, in that Bob Willis trophy as well. So I think that's it for today, Simon. What have you got any closing thoughts about this experience?
Well, it's been great to have everyone with us and to answer your questions. What was Andrew Fothergill saying? Because you're old, it needs to be exciting for the younger generation to watch it.
I think that was just a bit of abuse, basically, right, saying we're old and boring. And he's probably, it may mean he switched off, I don't know. But he might have learned something. He might have learned what the art of reverse swing was and why he kept dropping the ball down the leg side when he was playing for Durham. But he was actually a guy who lifted the team superbly. So it's been great to have him on, actually, even if it was only brief. He was an inspiration to play with, full of jokes and just enthusiasm generally. And we've had Jim Hindson on as well, actually, who played for Notts. So he'll be a bit elated after that slightly unexpected victory by Notts to beat Lancashire there, actually. So just one other thing to say, really, is that, as we said, we're going to start this as a series. And we've got some quite nice guests lined up. So we'll probably do it on a Thursday night, sort of 7 o'clock at night. And we'll post on social media when we're doing this sequence again. And we're trying to keep you interested and engaged in the art of the game of cricket, which we love so much. Try and get your chat, your feedback, and anything else you want to talk about, we want to try and discuss with you. So I hope you've enjoyed tonight. Simon, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. And thanks for everyone who joined us as well. Sean, says he enjoyed it, and looking forward to more in the future. We're looking forward to having you with us, Sean.
Yeah, thank you very much for everybody who attended. And if you're listening to the podcast, thanks also for listening. Speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.